Please be seated. I was surprised to find that if you do a Google search of Luke's Beatitude, "Blessed are you who are poor," you get about two real hits. But Matthew's version, "Blessed are the poor in spirit," conjures up a billion. I'm serious, I counted the zeros. Two hits for "Blessed are the poor," a billion for "Blessed are the poor in spirit." Now, maybe there are more entries buried in the list for scholars of Luke's version, the Sermon on a Level Plain, and for prophets of economic justice. But by an overwhelming factor, ordinary folks want to process "Blessed are you who are poor in spirit," then we want to engage "Blessed are the poor." I get it. "Blessed are you who are poor" was a shocking statement in the first century, and it still is. We are so shaped by our experience of the marketplace, where wealth equals freedom, and its lack is a very real and painful prison. "Blessed are the poor" literally doesn't compute. Then, as now, "blessed" was a common way of describing someone who was wealthy, not the opposite. And just to make things harder, the word "blessed" is also accurately translated as "happy" or "fortunate." The Jerusalem Bible, in fact, renders the verse, "Happy are the poor." And it goes on, "Happy are you who are hungry now. Happy are you who weep now. And happy are you when people hate you, drive you out, abuse you, and denounce your name as a criminal. Happy? What gives?" Two things are happening at once. Within the story, Jesus, the teacher, is in radical solidarity with those crowding around him, a large gathering who've come to hear him teach and be healed. Students and followers and strangers and the 12, all in one way or another living with their backs against the wall. And in the narrator's telling, these folks being healed are either the worst of the worst or in the worst possible predicament. They're the caught, the crippled, the unclean, anyone who knows he has nothing left to lose. And so Luke uses the shocking language to describe this shocking scene. Happy are the poor. They're happy. We're so out of touch with it, it doesn't even strike us as strange. We just kind of go along and say, yeah, blessed are the poor. When was the last time you looked at an empty bank account and said, boy, am I happy? When did you look at your living room and it was cold because you couldn't afford to pay the heat and said, boy, I'm feeling great today? What's he up to? How do we hear it? What's there now for us? Luke's language choice is like Shakespeare's in the third act of Romeo and Juliet, I believe. There, Friar Lawrence chides Romeo for his sullen histrionics after having been banished from the kingdom for killing Tybalt. You see, not able to stand the drama of this Renaissance teenager, the friar teaches Romeo that he is in fact fortunate, saying, "Thy Juliet is alive. There art thou happy." Do you remember the scene? "Tybalt would kill thee, but thou slewest Tybalt. There art thou happy. The law that threatened death becomes thy friend and turns it to exile. There art thou happy." He says, in other words, Romeo, you're in the briar patch. You're guilty of things you have done and a survivor of things that have been done to you. Suddenly, you know that life can be extraordinarily painful. But don't go back to sleep. Don't answer violence with more violence. Even in the most painful life, Romeo, there's beauty and perhaps love and healing. There
art thou happy?
The internet's preference for Matthew's version, the poor in spirit, then, is perhaps a youthful misreading that says more about us than the gospel. Being utterly humbled, dying, if you will, has always been the prerequisite for truly living. We run from it. But this poverty is the crucible of our transformation, prelude somehow to grace. You see, like Shakespeare's Romeo, consciousness of one's utter dependence on something inside, on one's inner worth and strength, is the key to the kingdom. Understanding that human value is not defined by physical prowess or family connections or good looks or wealth or being male or white or straight or even free. Look, ancient grudges don't have to kill us or our children, but they will as long as we define value by possessions or tribe or race. We know that because we're living it. The friar says, young men's love lies not truly in their hearts, but in their eyes, in things, in power over instead of power with, in the world. I think we can do better than Romeo's adolescents. Where do we lay up our treasures? Will you consider poverty as a blessing and not just something to run from? It's hard for us. We spend our lives making sure we're as far away from poverty as we possibly can. We've built the structures that ensure our place in the world, which is defined by what we have and the power we wield. It is not, by and large, based on the quality of your character. It's based on external standards, and all of us have drunk from that poison. Will you consider that poverty is a blessing? Gustavo Gutierrez said, God has a preferential love for the poor, not because they are necessarily better than others morally, religiously, or in any other way, but simply because they are poor and living in inhuman situations that are contrary to God's will. The ultimate basis for the privileged position of the poor, he continues, is not in the poor per se, but in the universal love of God, who loves everyone and goes everywhere, even and especially to the places where most of us fear to tread. The poor are pushed to the wall, and in their particular pain, they can see, if they will, that all of life is radically dependent on God. When one is not poor, this beatitude can mystify us or leave us cold or make us feel guilty. Like the rich young ruler, we can hear the Lord's invitation to give it all up, but then we go away sorrowful because we have so much. Well, I'm asking you, and I'm asking myself, not to run away from the sorrow or the guilt or the awkwardness for just a few minutes. Stay for a while in the shocking notion that poverty or hunger or sadness can be blessed, a prelude to grace, the crucible of transformation. Praying Bill was an Old Testament prophet who lived on the streets of Wilmington, Delaware. 30 years ago, he was a college professor in California when he heard a voice from God which invited him to let go of his stuff. Give everything away, the voice said, that is keeping you, Bill, from being you. Now, when I was a young priest who knocked on the doors in the streets of his neighborhood, Praying Bill would call me periodically with a word from God to me. I love that. He'd just call me up. David, God has spoken to me about you. And because I was a young dad and the hours I kept were different from Praying Bill's schedule, he usually left messages on my voicemail. When I laughed with him about his ease with modern technology, Pray and Bill didn't miss a beat. Hey, baby, anything by any means necessary. And his message was pretty consistent. Jesus was poor. Jesus came for the poor. David, give it all away. We have so many defenses set up to keep us from this reality. Our cars, our houses, our academic degrees, our social pedigree, who we know, who knows us, our gender if we're male, our color if we're white, the compromises we make, the ways that we sell out. Let it go. Let it all go right now, if just for a minute. Let God peel back the layers to your authentic self. Why do we think vulnerability is so fearsome? What does being empty-handed and open-hearted have to teach us? Let yourself see you as God sees you, freed from your defenses, however socially acceptable or enviable they may be. In God, we are immeasurably rich, but our access to this value is through the ways that we are poor. Think. What do I not know? Rather than leading always with, what can I do for you and how can I teach you something? Consider this posture. What do I not know? And then we learn. Consider, what do I not see? Instead of going into a situation saying, can I point out to you all the problems that you've got? Instead, go in saying, well, what can I not see? And see what somebody else can help you see. That's identifying poverty. Consider, the fastest growing sector of the U.S. economy is the service industry. But the most common jobs in service do not provide a living wage. Do we just accept market values as a given? Or do we push for kingdom values to hold more sway? Look, each of us has been disinherited in some way. Either literally by your family, if you stood up for some different way than theirs, or by your gender, or your sexuality, or by our culture, which says our value comes from wealth or winning or wielding power over others instead of finding solidarity with the common good. The norms of our culture insist that some people are better than others, that violence is a credible option, that the pie is limited and not everyone gets a piece. And we've all drunk from the cup of that poison. The revelation of Jesus is that there's a different way, a manner of seeing that discovers value inside, a message of hope that says, however the world or our structures may disinherit us, each of us is an inheritor of God's kingdom within, that looks at the world and calls its lies a lie and offers something which is older and deeper and more true. I got a late Christmas letter a while back from a friend in Louisiana. She included a photograph of a neighbor's house that was all but destroyed by Hurricane Ida this fall. She writes, "The picture of this ruined house evokes for me the moment in history when a child was born in a shack because there was no place for him in any other part of the village. The best place they could offer, hastily swept clean to welcome the frightened family, was a humble and vulnerable place that is familiar to most people who are poor. They did the best they could do. They didn't let that little family wait outside. They swept up what we would kind of call the garage and said, it's not much, but it's what we've got. In their poverty, they found something to offer. And God incarnate is a humble God, a vulnerable God, a God in solidarity. A humble God, my friend wrote. Humble in the good sense of the word, where ability, preparation, and love are simply placed in the service of others. A vulnerable God, There's no other way to describe a divine baby trusted to the care of human beings, young and poor, living in an occupied land. A God in solidarity, not looking for palaces or fine clothing or brilliant jewels, but coming near to the people, willing while we try to find out how to receive him with our limited resources. My friend continues, the disaster of Ida left us trembling and left us to discover one more time the vulnerability and poverty of ourselves and our neighbors. Is God in the hurricane? Have we been forgotten? She wonders. And then she proclaimed, I do not intend to minimize the disaster nor to defend God. I only intend to not remain mired in the mud. That's the strength of poverty. That's what those people who gathered on that plane so long ago with Jesus, that was their reality. They didn't have anything else. But they were saying by coming to him, I will not be mired in the mud anymore because I'm worth something. And he saw that in him and they saw it in him. What will you do with your poverty? Will you touch it? Will you stop running away from it and let it reveal what it has to reveal to you? And what about the poverty of our neighbors? Each of us has been disinherited in some way by the norms of our culture, which say our value comes from wealth or winning or wielding power over others, instead of inviting us always to find solidarity with the common good. We've all drunk from the cup of that poison. But Jesus has another idea. The human being fully alive is more than what she has, and more even than what anyone can take away from her. Our poverty, so-called, is the beginning of wisdom, the foundation of God's kingdom, the hard and trampled soil of our spirits, where doubts and loves dig up the world, says the poet, like a mole or a plow, and a whisper can be heard in the place where the ruined house once stood. And that voice whispers, I too will rise. Amen.